Mind Crime Liberty Show with me, Swithin Dobson, and him, Tim Patton. Today we discuss the US Supreme Court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg has kicked the bucket, and there's a massive clamour over who will replace her and when that should take place. Should that take place before the election or after the election? Should we really care about the Supreme Court? Does the Supreme Court have too much power? And even in a more broadly libertarian society, would an organisation like the Supreme Court have to exist? Tim?
The Supreme Court is an interesting phenomenon. It might not have been exactly envisioned by the framers of the U.S. Constitution, or it may have been envisioned by it. It sort of made itself sovereign, sort of carved it out. It wasn't explicitly written into it. This was designed by the other branches of the government. But nonetheless, the Supreme Court, at least recently, and actually for much of its history, has held a huge amount of sovereign power in the United States. If you read someone like Carl Schmitt and Keith Preston's article about Carl Schmitt, what is sovereign? Who is sovereign? The thing that decides the exceptions, as Carl Schmitt would say. And the Supreme Court is the thing in which decides what exactly is and isn't constitutional in the United States in general. And I think the Supreme Court resolves the intractable disputes within the U.S. Now, what interests me about this is a Supreme Court a good libertarian idea? Because even in a libertarian society, I'd assume there'd be something like arbitration, or there's something like courts that would exist to resolve disputes. I presume disputes would arise. And the way that, traditionally is it's done, and I presume libertarians do, is through courts of some kind, or arbitration. Now, of course, arbitration in courts can be done somewhat privately. But nonetheless, you need to have, ultimately, in some ways, over some geographical territory. Now, this could be, I could imagine a private law society or, some sort of freedomite, different competing protection agencies. They have different rules, maybe. So some areas have some rules. Other areas might have different rules. But within a given area, you can't have both. Only one thing can be the case. It can't be both A and not A, so to speak. And certain intractable issues like abortion. There's really no middle ground functionally. You can make an unprincipled compromise, 2 plus 2 equals 5 instead of 2 plus 2 equals 4, or 2 plus 2 equals 6. An unprincipled compromise is 5. Try to construct that. And in some ways, the Supreme Court is good at, the Supreme Court in the United States is good at creating these kind of unprincipled but livable compromises. You can't teach both evolution. You can try to teach both evolution and intelligent design or something like that. But at the end of the day, which is going to be dominant and which is what's going to be backed up by the courts? And in the libertarian world, it would be whatever. Again, you could have competing institutions and private education and so forth. So that wouldn't be a problem. But like with abortion, for example, either abortion is a crime, it's murder, and the people should be punished as murderers, or it's just like removing an ulcer. And we see this if you look at the existing nation states today. Take an issue like pornography. If you go to Indonesia, you could get yourself caned. You could get yourself, in even parts of Singapore, in all likelihood, you can get yourself caned. You can all those sorts of things. Same way if you go to parts of Europe, United States, or in Canada, it's actually a hate crime to criticize certain aspects of like gay lifestyle and so forth. So as you see, things are either the one way or the other way. And in the U.S., as the sovereign document is the Constitution, the organization that interprets the sovereign doctrine is a Supreme Court that interprets the exceptions or the tough cases, not the areas where there's agreements, but the areas where there's disagreement. Now, of course, you can always say decentralization. But one interesting argument Michael Malice makes, and he made this in his Hamilton versus Jefferson debate, it's not a Hamilton versus Jefferson. Malice was arguing, is Hamilton a hero for the cause of liberty? That was the premise of the debate. One of the points Malice has made is that Hamilton was an elitist. And he was, I'm in a way agnostic on the elitist populist question. I think there's both sides make decent arguments in favor and against. But nonetheless, the Supreme Court, in a way, is an elitist institution par excellence. And the Supreme Court, again, in the United States, is one of the most independent institutions. It's not elected directly, and you're in for life. I mean, it's very much far away from the mob. You don't have to re-campaign every 4 years. In some ways, it's like an elected monarchy. So that's another interesting cause for it. It's like an elected monarchy. You get someone like Clarence Thomas. I mean, he doesn't have a constituency. I mean, if the U.S. government falls apart, and of course, if you want to think the U.S. government is legitimate, you're fair to do so. But as I pointed out earlier, it seems like courts will exist in a libertarian society. So would a similar institution exist in that? And back to the question, is it a good idea? So those are my overview. I think one of the interesting things about it is it does resolve the contradictions, because there's plenty of things that, you know, and abortion is a classic issue. I mean, it's either like removing a tooth or an ulcer, which, you know, in most Western countries, you know, it's basically, you know, you say, well, your health insurance should take care of it. Or it's like a murder. There's no middle ground. And there's plenty of other issues where it's either this or that. And it's, in theory, you need some organization. And if you have competing organizations, there'll be some, they would maybe, and David Friedman talked about this, like the different RPAs would craft some agreement between each other about what is legal and what isn't legal, or what they will prosecute, or what if someone brings a dispute against them, is it okay for you to cause damages and so forth. So Swithin, so far, what do you think of my argument here regarding the Supreme Court supremacy, and is it a libertarian thing? It is far away from the mob. It is a very elitist institution. It's not connected to people in any direct way. Swithin?
I do think there needs to be a mechanism to determine what the law is ultimately. So the question is, what ought that mechanism be? As you point out, let's suppose you have an organization which is babies' rights, for example, and some woman has an abortion in a certain area, and then babies' rights say, well, you've committed murder, we should be prosecuted and punished. And then, of course, the woman says, well, no, abortion is fine and okay. Well, you need a way of arbitrating that. Also, I do think there'd be people who would pay for rights protection agencies to actually pay for enforcement of, as it were, other people's rights. I do think that likely, because I think some people would think of a rights protection agency similar in certain respects to voting. And as Brian Kaplan points out, people don't tend to vote in a way that you think they might do based on sort of just purely on sort of material rational self-interest. And I think something similar may happen with rights protection agencies. So the question then is, how do you go about determining what the ultimate law is in a particular area? So it might be worthwhile bringing up now the British or the English solution to this problem. Prior to the Human Rights Act, which was passed in 1998 by the Blair government, the UK did not have a Supreme Court. We had what was called the Law Lords. They were judges who were members of the House of Lords, which is a second chamber, which is similar to the Senate, except at least until relatively recently, it was primarily hereditarily based. That is, the aristocrats would basically dominate the House of Lords. Some of the bishops would do from the church, but primarily a hereditary institution. And so some judges would get there, and any final court case could go to the Law Lords, but they sat in the House of Lords. Ultimately, you could actually call upon the entirety of the House of Lords to adjudicate a case, not just the Law Lords, all peers who were all lords. But that hadn't happened for a good number of years, probably to the 19th century. I don't remember the exact date. But when it came to kind of what was legal and what wasn't, effectively in England before then, whatever Parliament passed in statute was basically law. And in principle, there was nothing that they couldn't do with respect to the the laws that they pass. So effectively, you could say that Parliament, or more precisely, the Crown in Parliament is sovereign. Parliament passes a bill, becomes law, becomes a statute, and whatever that says goes. And there's no way of, there's no sort of constitutional court to say whether this is right or wrong. So you can just pass whatever you so wish. Now that changed with the Human Rights Act, because I can't remember the precise details, but that spawned the Supreme Court, which the UK now has, which then moved outside the Law Lords and was in a separate building. And it's kind of getting towards sort of like the American style separation of powers, which we don't have, really. And it didn't really do anything. No one really cared about it until the Brexit case, basically, which came to them, which was something called prorogation. Prorogation is a parliamentary instrument whereby the Prime Minister can ask the Queen to prorogue Parliament. Basically, he can't do anything for a certain period of time. The limits to this are basically that they can't do it for really not more than a year, because if they do, they need a Parliament to pass a budget. And so if they can't pass a budget, they don't have any money. So there would always be basically a year. This would be the longest. You could basically just say Parliament isn't sitting. And this was basically to stop Remainers sabotaging leaving the European Union. But then the Remainers got into lots of legal disputes and stuff and eventually went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said basically that prorogation was unconstitutional. And this is the first time anything like this has ever happened. And interestingly, to quote from the Supreme Court case, it said stopping Parliament sitting was against the Constitution because the House of Commons, quote, the House of Commons as the elected representatives of the people has the right to vote, close quote. So for the first time, it actually recognized kind of sort of popular sovereignty as the basis of the UK Constitution. And prior to that, that simply would not have been recognized. It would have been, you know, this is a goings on within Parliament. Parliament can do what they want, effectively, or the Queen via her ministers can do that, because it's something within Parliament, not anything outside of it. So the UK now does have a form of a Supreme Court. Now, I don't like the Supreme Court that we have here, basically because I despise judges, because I see them primarily as the managerial elite who are basically formed primarily in, you could refer to as an enemy class. They maintain entrenched economic interests, and they're a tool of cultural leftism. So I have absolutely no faith in them whatsoever. So on a pragmatic basis, I would prefer the previous system, basically that, well, the hereditary peers and the law lords were at least not quite as bad as most of the judiciary typically are. And if you didn't like them, you could in principle change the law, which you can't do if you have a Supreme Court based on sort of a written constitution. That said, I do think you do need an ultimate decision-making body to determine what the law is. But having an American-style Supreme Court based on a written constitution, which is explicitly written, I wouldn't support.
I want to bring up the point you made about the RPAs being, in some ways, like Brian Kaplan's model of voting. I mean, we already see this today. Peter Thiel assisted, what I'm not sure of the exact name, but it's known as Hulk Hogan, go after BuzzFeed for thing. So we can see that, you know, private actors finance certain crusades. You could call them crusades. In some ways, that's exactly what they are, for better or for worse. Even left wing wolves will use this strategy too. You know, you could imagine if you concoct some anti-racist law or something like that, you find your boogeyman and you start suing them. I think the Southern Poverty Law Center probably does some assistance, some version of this as well. So I mean, in this society, we'd have courts, and there'd be competing courts, and there'd be competing jurisdictions and competing places where you could competing legal theories. But you do need some kind of agreement, and I do think it is interesting. I'm not sure if the United States could have existed The House of Representatives and the Senate would have been much more sovereign if, and the Constitution actually been less important if I don't, if the Supreme Court did not continually exist. And this is where it gets tricky, the federalism, the centralization, decentralization argument. Because in the United States, and this is one of the upsides of written Constitution, as bad as written Constitution can be, the first 10 amendments, and you get the 10th Amendment, and you get the First Amendment. I mean, the amendments to it are quite good. A limitation of state power. I mean, my own home state has recently, a variety of private people have sued the governor on the grounds that it's the lockdown. It's not called a lockdown. It's health emergency laws or something like that. And said they're arbitrary and therefore they're unconstitutional. But they did it through the federal court system, which eventually would go to the Supreme Court, which would eventually come down to who's on the Supreme Court. This to me is the intersection of like of almost all my interest area, because you have on the one hand you have just pure political power, on the other hand you have like truth, and the other hand you have like, you know, theorems and argumentation, and it all sort of intersects right there. So again, I'm not saying I'm a supporter of it, or necessarily, but if you believe in courts in some ways, which again, libertarians seem to in general think they will exist in some degree in their future, you do need a decider. And this goes the Supreme Court has gone back and forth on all sorts of issues. But nonetheless, on balance, looking from your position, do you think the Supreme Court has protected liberty as libertarians conceive of it? Do you think that is the case? I think there's some cases it has. There are certain questions where it's unclear. I mean, the Supreme Court historically was one of the most pro-slavery institutions and also one of the least slavery institutions. But that depends on what your view on slavery is as well. Same with child labor laws as too. Yeah. So nonetheless, based on the way most libertarians and libertarians broadly conceive of liberty, is the Supreme Court a good idea? And is written Constitution a good idea, interpreted by a Supreme Court or something like that? Because even in Rothbard land, you still have something like interpretation of the NEP. You know, what exactly is aggression? So you still end up with certain problems, which you identified. Swithin?
Okay, so has the U.S. Supreme Court defended liberty? I don't know the U.S. Supreme Court cases well enough to be able to say that definitively. There's clearly been cases where they have, particularly tend to be around free speech more than anything else. They've probably been the best at, from my relatively limited knowledge of the Supreme Court. But there's clearly been cases where they haven't. And just one, like they're going back and forth on precedents. I had a quick look at this earlier, and there's a Wikipedia entry, and the U.S. Supreme Court has overruled itself in over 300 cases. And interesting when you mentioned child labor, that was one of the ones that they had. So in 1918, they said that the federal government couldn't regulate child labor. And then in 1941, they said that they could. This is all based on, as ever, our good friend, the Commerce Clause, which has caused great excitement amongst legal theorists, etc. When it comes to written constitutions, I think the problem with a specifically written constitution is you just get bogged down into the minutiae of meaning of words. And if you look at a text longer and hard enough, you can pretty much get it to say what you want it to say. You can circumscribe the language. I mean, a good example would be, they haven't done this yet, but with respect to sort of like the Second Amendment, it's, well, you know, did they really mean modern type of guns? Did they just really mean muskets? Or you get into these disputes as to, oh, what, and that's even if you wanted to take a, an intentionalist view, an originalist view of the document. And then if you want to take always a more of a living document, so we basically say what you want to say anyway, then all bets are off anyway. I always think that the reason why free speech has been protected by the US, the Supreme Court to a large extent, is primarily because I think there's still an attachment to free speech in American society. And so because the judges are from that sort of environment, they rule in that manner. Now, the way things are going, that might change. And there may be innovative arguments that, the regulation of speech and the First Amendment, they'll create some sort of circumscribing of it such that it doesn't apply in a certain situation that they don't like. So I would say, really, even though I think if you're going to take a written constitution seriously, you've kind of broadly got to take an originalist view. In fact, the result is always, in a sense, a living one, because if people want something to happen, they will make it happen. So I think, that said, I do think you could make an argument that, let's say, if you want to take the ethics of liberty as your base, I'm not saying we necessarily should take the ethics of liberty as sort of the constitutional document, but so if you were, the ethics of liberty is primarily a sort of broad principles document. It's not minutiae. You can do this, 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 and this, or the government can't do this, this, and this. It's a broader principle document. And I think if you had a group of people who were basing on principles, as such, as opposed to sort of just written words, you could to some extent avoid the being bogged down and sort of changing the meaning of words. I mean, the best example, I think, is the meaning of words is the Roe v. Wade case, irrespective of whether you think abortion is a good idea or not. The fact that they said, you couldn't ban it in a state because of the right to privacy, is only a ruling an intelligent man could find compelling. Anybody who wasn't quite sophisticated would just go, well, that's stupid, as a type of reasoning. So I do think, you know, broad principles, and I would also say, actually, with a supreme sort of body, I think the way I would approach it would be, I wouldn't say that they have to rule on each legal case. I think the only, as to whether jump on one side or the other, it would be more of a case of, you could only go to the institution if you thought that some ruling from a judge was clearly and obviously outside the principles. So it's not kind of judging on marginal cases. It would, because you'd be like, in a sense, you can put up with marginal cases in certain applications and just leave those to particular judges, I think. It might depend on the particular case, I suppose. But the reason I mention that is you effectively get different judicial rulings all the time. I mean, you've got the hierarchical court system. But I mean, for example, if you get somebody who comes in front of one judge or a different judge, they'll get different sentences, even if it's the same offence. So in a sense, you do have this. Now, I suppose that's only on sentencing, as opposed to what the law is, I suppose. But it does show that there's sort of heterogeneity even within the current sort of American and British legal codes. So I think more important is the mechanism by which you determine who the sort of council of elders or this sort of supreme body is, as opposed to what the supreme body is supposed to do, because the supreme body will just do what it wants.
I do think the initial dismissal of the idea of the Supreme Court, which at times gets in certain libertarian circles, is a little bit too quick out of hand due to the legalists. I'm not sure if I'm going to use that word, but in the sense that there are disputes which are, to a certain extent, disputes over the definition of words. I do think, in a way, you know, the abortion one's a classic one. You know, the ruling is in some ways idiotic, but it is an unprincipled way to resolve a very fairly intractable issue. Now, of course, you could just say, well, United States is just too big. But you could probably argue that most societies are too big. Britain's probably too big. France is too big. Almost all societies are too big. How big would the RPAs in a how will be the scale? Now, again, I know a person like Stefan Gensel doesn't necessarily like to make predictions, but I do think you can sort of to a certain extent extrapolate problems. And in this regard, the Supreme Court of the United States has resolved it. And actually now, currently, Britain has sort of adopted this institution. And as you, I think you stated privately, it's the first time, I think you stated it before, it's the first time you said that Parliament's power rests in the people. This is actually where the United States is technically, the founding document is probably sovereign, in the sense that the Constitution itself is sovereign. And this is where the Carl Schmitt article becomes much more interesting. This is where the Supreme Court might prevent a revolution from within, so to speak, you know, from within the government trying to overthrow the existing order, saying that, you know, and this is where you know, Schmitt argues, I'm not sure if it was Keith Pressner or Schmitt argues, that what the Germans have done in the 1930s is just outlaw the far left and far right parties. Because both of them were clamoring, once they got in, they would just overthrow the existing order. In this regard, to bring up many people, including libertarians' favorite boogeyman, Joe McCarthy was entirely right. You bring in outside agitators in that regard. You know, they wanted to overthrow the principles which the existing society was built on. So I do think there are issues within sovereignty. And I do think that the issues that are identified at the Supreme Court would be similar to the issues in which might beset a possible libertarian society. Because I do think you'd have Margaret Sanger, Inc., and I do think you'd have Gary North, Inc., both competing. One group would go to, you know, I could fairly easily, in certain countries that you have Muslims and secular people, you know, in Indonesia, for example, I was reading up on this, there are certain areas where homosexuality is outright illegal, even for, I think it's even illegal for non-Muslims at this point, it's definitely not something that you could want to do. And actually, you'll have people call the police on their neighbors. So in some ways, you have and there's a great article from actually Human Rights Watch on this. You get the police, the clerics and the police get in league together to enforce these laws. So I do think in a possible future libertarian society, because one of the problems with abortion is who exactly the crime is committed against. Well, it's the child, the fetus, that thing. Well, you know, if you have someone who wants to adopt the child, and this is like Gary North, Inc. will say, they could be saying they could just file for damages. We want this child. Although alternatively, Margaret Sanger, Inc. could just also file for damages as well. So I do think this is an interesting issue, because I think the Supreme Court decides the interesting issues. As you stated, the marginal cases go away. No one really cares. And even most property disputes, except over certain property, are fairly marginal. Most people can be negotiated with. You know, maybe there's a few plots of land throughout the world or that people are specifically attached to, the hills that people would die on. But there are, you know, certain principles related to labor and certain intractable issues, you know, and those like things. So, Swithin, any comments on what I've said about possible libertarian societies' problems regarding RPAs, as well as the issue of sovereignty? Swithin?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously going to be disputes between rights protection agencies, and on certain issues, you're just going to have a mechanism by which to say what will be sort of enforced in the area, unless you're just going to end up with violence all the time. So let's assume we're going to have, for purpose of argument, we're going to have a sort of stable, non-violent, broadly non-violent equilibrium, which raises, I think, the what you've mentioned so far. I think the biggest problem, say, with the Supreme Court as it currently stands in the US is that it is over too far, 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 far too large geographical area. If it was over a much smaller area and you had more of a sort of a pan-anarchist approach to things, then the rulings would be less important, Well, they still perform a very important social function. But if you happen to dislike it for whatever reason, then you could, you know, relatively easily go somewhere else. Or much more easily than you can at present. So I think the area over which the Supreme Court currently has power is the reason why it's such a hot button issue, because the views of the coasts, for example, are not the views of the centre. I think that's probably broadly true. I would also say as well, the fact that the US federal government now does so much, there's more cases effectively for there to go to the Supreme Court to begin with. So in Rothbard Stand, for example, yes, you would get disputes over what the NAP were, but that's and what violation of that constituted. But the number of kind of theoretical cases that you could create based on that, assuming, let's assume that Rothbardian ethics is consistent. Let's assume it is for the purpose of argument. I mean, the areas over which you can have sort of legitimate dispute is so much more circumscribed than it is when you have, say, for example, the US federal government claiming under the Commerce Clause it can regulate employment contracts, etc. I mean, that situation simply would not exist. In a sort of libertarian society, you will, to a large extent, have fewer cases that, well, in fact, says there are fewer crimes, or there's at least fewer things that people think are crimes, which is more the relevant point. And so there's less need for judges because there's less crimes, fewer crimes, sorry. Yeah, it's still a problem. I think one of scale is the biggest issue. If you were to allow the, I'll put it this way, if it was the case that there was no, let's the easiest example. Let's suppose the United States of America didn't really exist as a country. It was a loose federation, and basically the states were sovereign. Would there be as much concern over who the appointment was to the Texan Supreme Court as there is with the United States Supreme Court? No. Because probably more likely coming from a more similar population, the views of that individual will probably on average be closer to the population of Texas, just because he's basically from Texan society. And Texan society is less diverse than the society of the United States of America. So it's an issue of the rules over which the Supreme Court would need to rule and the geographical area over which it needs to rule.
This is what's interesting. No one knows. Most people have asked won't even know who's on their state Supreme Courts. And I think that is basically relevant because most people don't care. Again, you can get into sort of esoteric arguments about how free the West, you know, is or isn't. I'm perfectly willing to say it's entirely not free, but I will defend the West vis-a-vis Cuba or East Germany. I mean, if people are going to argue that somehow those societies are more free, I will defend the United States. And I would defend Britain, even though the recent shenanigans maybe make me question a little bit. But nonetheless, in general, I would argue that the United States is broadly free. But most people, and even libertarians, many things that there will be less things that are illegal. There probably will be less crimes. Although there are still plenty of things the current state does that would still be done in the future society that most people would agree about. This is what a lot of the Supreme Court, this is what a lot of the actual day-to-day function of the courts would be. Again, and I would imagine in this future, if it ever happens, version of libertarianism, that would also be it. So yeah, but the Supreme Court itself, the reason why it's so contentious is the amount of power. You know, this whole society, there's a huge amount of cultural distance now, not just geographical distance, and probably more importantly, cultural distance in the United States. Between, I think there's an increasing number of tribes in the United States, and the tribes just have intractable disputes within them. The only way the United States functions currently, arguably, is with the federal government and the Supreme Court. I mean, it's actually impressive how long the American experiment, the American experiment, considering the number of people, the variety and diversity of people, has lasted. I mean, a lot of people criticize that, but considering the number of rather disparate groups, which, you know, ex-slaves, enslaved, you know, Hispanics, Puritans, Amish, Mormons, it is really quite remarkable. It is really quite remarkable. I know it's sometimes considered taboo to say nice things, but, you know, again, what really should happen is we have more competing legal institutions. And that should be the real goal. That would resolve a huge amount of these disputes here. And that's the only way forward here. But I'm going to switch gears. I think what we should focus right now on is, you know, the question is, what should Republicans do here in the United States? My view, there's two actions. There's either step into the abyss and go and try to win the election, or try to get a, you know, some sort of libertarian or some sort of conservative into the court. Or there's to play the nice guy strategy, the nice civil strategy, and just say, oh, well, let's put a moderate there, play it safe, you know, let the other party decide. It's their seat. We should put another, you know, liberal woman in there. So there's two strategies I'm going for. So Swithin, what strategy should the Republicans and the Trump administration broadly pursue? The civil nice guy strategy or the more mean brutalist strategy? Swithin?
Well, firstly, the nice guy strategy might work if you could have any confidence that the other side would play nice in the same situation, or that there is actually any goodwill for people following the spirit of the law. There isn't. And consequently, there is no point. I've seen some sort of normie con, soft sort of conservative type saying, oh, we should do this, you know, we should reach out and make the first move, you know, and not do it until after the election, you know, and show that, you know, we're trying to de-escalate. It's like, we're beyond that point. That might be a prudential strategy in a certain circumstance, but that's not where we are. And that's not going to be a good idea. So do you take the brutal strategy? Well, you could have it before or after the election. The issue is, if it's close, the problem with leaving it till after the election is you could go to a Supreme Court where there could be a tie. I don't know how that's resolved. It might be that Justice Roberts gets the casting vote because he's the most senior. But I'm not entirely sure how that works. So on a pragmatic basis, if something ends up going, a challenge goes up to the Supreme Court, you need to be able to have it to get a 5-4 win. Because if the Supreme Court ends up with 4-4, like, all bets are off. What happens then? Also, it raises the interesting question as to whether or not America is a republic or it's a democracy. Because a lot of people are saying, oh, no, but people should have a chance to vote for their candidates, because so they now know that the Supreme Court is a potential issue and they can factor that in with their voting, which makes sense as far as it goes. But you can easily respond, well, Ginsburg was like, what, 83 when Trump was elected in 2016? Like, you know, average age, youth of the population, yeah, probably not going to last too much longer. So you could claim that this should have been in the back of their minds then. I mean, certainly was among some of the supporters of Trump. They didn't particularly like him, but they said, oh, well, the Supreme Court was what was the important thing. So, for example, the theologian Wayne Grudem did that. So they probably need one earlier, and the system is what it is, and the president can suggest anyone he so pleases, if this is cleared by the Senate. I think it's just Senate or the House of Representatives. And so, yeah, that's absolutely fine. I mean, it's perfectly within the law for the speaker, I think, not to hold a vote if he doesn't want one. If the president suggests one, that's all part of the rule book. So, yeah, I would say, although he won't do this, you know, just go now and just pick, like, Judge Napolitano or someone like that and just go, don't care. We don't care about this sort of split. The whole point of the Supreme Court was just to judge on constitutional matters. And, you know, we're going to take, you know, the Constitution says what it says and we just want someone to interpret it properly. That was Scalia's position. Surely all the judges should have that position. The fact that they don't have that position is the reason why, in a sense, it's become so politicized. So he should just set someone up for a vote and vote on them and get them through. The Democrats would do exactly the same thing. And on a strategic level, the Republicans have always gone on about how important the Supreme Court is. So when you've got the opportunity, use it. Now, the left will go insane, but they're going insane anyway. So that's my advice.
Correct. I broadly agree with your advice. There is a danger in the strategy. In the danger strategy is they out-brutalize you. That's always the strategy. But if you presume that strategy, that might happen inevitably, then the conservative strategy of just keep trying to win small victories, which is actually which requires the brutal strategy. And we have unreleased episodes about progressivism. This is a progressive thing to do. In Thomas Sowell's view, this is the limited views. This is the, you know, the tragic or the small view. The whole U.S. government is probably, most of the U.S. government is unconstitutional. I mean, in a way, that's the problem. I mean, Hans Hoppe has a great lecture on Marx. I mean, in a way, it's just outside of the class interests of most normie Republicans and Democrats to actually interpret the Constitution in any remote way, in remotely originalist way. As it was outside the class interests of the Hamiltonians and the Lincolnians and the Jeffersonians as well, and so forth. So yeah, the brutalist strategy is the strategy I would adopt. Will they adopt it? Who knows? I do hope they do it, because again, you get these elected. I think there is some interesting features about the Supreme Court. They are an elected monarchy. They are independent. You get the whole Hayekian argument, why the worst gets on top. And I think broadly the Hayekian argument about why the worst get on top is true. To become a politician is a sort of brutal job. I'm fairly agnostic on Trump. If someone really pushes me, Trump the person. I mean, the guy is hilarious. I mean, I like that factor. His Trumpisms are hilarious. He's the only Rosie O'Donnell. But the guy is no philosopher. The guy's no theologian. The guy's a showman. I mean, so in some ways you need people there. And I think the closest we can get in the existing society, or to build it out of the shell of the old society, is to hijack the Supreme Court and keep it hijacked. You know, and this goes back to, in a way, when you talk about, well, do we live in a republic or a democracy? I mean, that's the question. That is the question in itself. I mean, and this goes back to Carl Schmitt. You know, many democracy supporters, you know, I've had this debate in college, like, you know, can't we vote on killing our neighbors? Well, the Democratic supporters are saying, no, we can't vote on that. That's not up for to vote. Well, why not? You know, why shouldn't killing off minorities, or majorities for that matter, be relevant? I mean, why shouldn't we vote on who owns one's labor? You know, I mean, this is one of the problems I have with democracy in general. And I don't think you could say I'm strawmanning or parodying my opponent's position. I don't think it's very far. I don't think it's very far from it, of a parody, because I don't see any recourse. I mean, in some ways, Germany was a democracy. The Weimar Republic was a liberal democracy, which is everyone's, what came after the Weimar Republic is everyone's favorite boogeyman. So yes, Republicans should take the brutalist strategy and then just stack it with with what most people would call lunatics. And I think they would do, I think they would do a lot of positive good if they'd stack it with a bunch of lunatics. of what most people would consider lunatics. Although, of course, the big problem is the Supreme Court is relatively independent. I think that's one of the key features of it. So I think an outright dismissal by libertarians of the idea of a Supreme Court is problematic. Even if you want to, in a future libertarian society, if you want to even concoct something like the NAP or some similar institution, or even the common law system, there are major disputes that have decided. Now, of course, you'd always have it on smaller things, but the independence of it, I think is key. I think for better or for worse, independence can cut two ways. You can cut the way that you want it to go, and you can cut the way you don't want it to go. I think it's likely that you could, again, stack it with a bunch of what everyone else sees as lunatics, and you could do a lot of positive good. You could do a lot of positive good, and not just good in the way libertarians see, which I think is the actual good. I think a smaller U.S. state would be better. I mean, if local governments want to have large local state governments want to have these programs, they can have them. They can have them as much as they want. You could concoct more federalism if places like Massachusetts and California want to, you know, have their own things. Go ahead, we can concoct that out. But Swithin, any comments on the independence and, you know, some libertarian skepticism toward the Supreme Court? So any final comments in general?
I mean, they are independent of the ruling executive at the time. But, of course, they're not purely independent. I mean, for example, I suppose constitutionally they can't. But I mean, if most of them kept doing what were considered utterly bizarre rulings, then eventually their power would be circumscribed somehow, or they'd be removed. It'd have to get pretty far for that to happen, but in principle that's possible. And you are right. They are independent, so they can just sort of change their minds, become more liberal. I mean, you could argue this is what Roberts has done, because he was touted as a great sort of conservative pick by George W. Bush, but then has now sort of moved, as it were, leftwards. They kind of are independent. Although I suppose the ultimate libertarian argument is, well, they're not independent of the government because they pay them. Now, as to the question of who you think is the government is another question. It's true they are separate from the executive, but they aren't separate from the system and independent in that sense. As to whether the independence is good and they're not sort of voted in regularly, I think that's probably generally a good idea in general, because it does insulate you from popular swings of mood, etc., etc. But given where we are, it's I would just sort of take the pragmatic position. If it is the case, for example, that Trump gets one in and then the left goes insane, well, that might end up getting them so upset that they riot, or maybe they say, "Oh no, well, California is going to leave the United States of America." At which point I'll say, hello, thank you, and bye-bye. I hope they'll do that. They might not. But, sort of radicalizing things in this way will hopefully have such a sort of outcome. But I do think, with Michael Malley said, the fact that they're far away from the mob is a good thing. The mob is kind of bad. I think the argument for sort of for monarchy to some extent is interesting, because you kind of decide beforehand who gets the position, and they're not deciding they have to have it via sort of Machiavellian moves and trying to ingratiate themselves with various people. They may be somewhat indifferent to the role that they have, which might actually make them make better decisions than they otherwise would, just because people who seek out power generally the least to be trusted to wield it. I think there's something to be said for hereditarianism to some extent, although I'm not necessarily advocating monarchy, but it does avoid that that problem that sort of democracy points out. And this is basically what Hans Hoppe makes. Yeah, Hans Hoppe basically makes that argument that democracy got it failed.
Yeah, I would agree. The interesting point about monarchy here, and that's part of the idea of this episode, is the Supreme Court elected a monarchy? I mean, one of the biggest problems historically with monarchies is, you know, what happens when the king dies? And in a way, this is exactly what's happening in the United States. What happens when one of these nine people die? It's almost like a constitutional crisis. And it's starting to resemble one, just because of when it's happened on top of this coronavirus stuff. There's a long on top of this contentious election and these mail-in ballots. It is in a way resembling a crisis. I mean, I mean reports of the. You did a recent roundtable on this. I mean, reports of, I think, the United States deaths been called way too many times. It sometimes resembles crying wolf. I mean, eventually the wolf does come, but it didn't come then. But it is going off into the abyss regardlessly. This is quite interesting territory. In some ways, it's a vanilla territory, though, because there's no reason why you can't quickly get someone in. The filibuster is no longer there, from my understanding. But those are about minor rules and so forth. But nonetheless, it is an interesting position because it might be away from the mob. And right-wing mobs aren't very, although I'm in some ways right-wing, in some ways I'm not right-wing at all. Right-wing mobs, I don't think are the friendliest group of people either. There's plenty of, lots of ink gets spilled about right-wing mobs and right-wing dictators. We don't need to go into it. But even so, whether or not will the Supreme Court actually, will the Supreme Court prevent them? I mean, in this regard, the left should be happy there's a Supreme Court, because you could just as equally argue that the Supreme Court has defended the rights of unpopular people here in the United States, and did it better than elected popular democracy would have defended. I think this is one of the cases where it gets really tricky. I mean, you could just argue the West actually defends minorities' rights the best, and actual minorities. Like the historical minorities. I mean, the Supreme Court does defend former enslaved people. The Supreme Court actually has a few of them descendants on it. So it is interesting. I mean, I do think the Supreme Court defends the unpopular people, whether they are right or left. It can. But they aren't truly independent. I totally agree with that point. But even a monarch in some ways isn't truly independent. I mean, everyone could just come in and overthrow the monarch as well. So in some ways, no one is independent. But I do. If I were predicting, if I were making a prediction, which predictions are sometimes tricky, especially about the future, I think libertarian societies would have to develop a similar institution, or at least some sort of agreements which resemble it. Or else you'd need some kind of council of elders, which would just be or a ruling principle, because you have to have some way to interpret the community, or else you need an elected king. You need a king who himself in his personness decides what is the case. Because like I said to start, there's certain things, and again, the marginal issues no one cares about. There's certain things that they can't be both A and not A. It's either a crime or isn't a crime. And what exactly can you get for damages? And those facts have to be decided what actually it is. And it is a functional system. It's the most Burkean institution in the United States. So that basically wraps up what I wanted to say overall about this institution. Again, if you want to think the U.S. government is illegitimate, go ahead. I'm perfectly willing to agree with you on that ground. But nonetheless, Swithin, any final comments?
I just say that, yeah, I do think a body needs to sort of determine what the law actually is. I suppose in Britain, that's now a Supreme Court, whereas previously it was kind of effectively the Senate, in a sense. But that the way to avoid more of the intractable problems to repeat. So have things over significantly smaller geographical areas. You did mention that no one really knows who's on the state Supreme Courts, probably because the state Supreme Courts don't have much power. I mean, if they were sort of like Texas was a country, then they may to some extent. And I think they probably would. As I say, I think you're going to get more sort of social cohesion that way. And it would be interesting to see what size these areas would take in sort of a broadly libertarian society. How large would sort of a law code spread? Because, I mean, interesting, you could make the claim that in medieval Europe, the legal code was very similar because it was also based off sort of Roman Catholic law, effectively. They said what was just and what was right, and then everyone sort of followed it. Now, I know there were different courts to enforce things, but, you know, what the law was you could argue, kind of upheld by that, and that was over a larger area. So it might be over a larger area, a smaller area, but in general, I think, you know, smaller area, less chance of sort of over violence and conflict, and, you know, you'll have a more sort of cohesive society overall. I just now like to thank everyone for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please share it with your friends and family and subscribe to us on Podbean, Spotify or YouTube. And if you'd like to contact the show with any ideas or comments, please contact us at mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com. That's mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com.